Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Tonight I'm looking at a phenomenal book, which I'd urge anyone to read, Stalin's Nemesis, The Exile and Murder of Leon Trotsky, by Bertrand Paternode. It's one of the best books that I have ever read on Soviet history, and on the power struggle to succeed Lenin, and obviously on the fate of Trotsky in his exile in Turkey and France and Mexico. But one of the things that's great about this book is that it's an intellectual history, and it goes in the final chapter into the kind of almost like the afterlife of Trotsky's ideas. And the reason why I want to talk about this and why it's important is that it's very difficult to understand the history of the left, the international left, in the 20th century without understanding the currents, the kind of the competing currents of Marxist-Leninism, Stalinism, Trotskyism, and democratic socialism, and where they intersect. And there are some surprising aspects to the kind of the story of Trotskyism, of his kind of adherents, and people who you know, in some ways saw them as themselves as his disciples. There were those who eventually spiral off to essentially neoconservatism and neoliberalism, and who reject entirely Trotsky's ideas. And there are those who have carried the torch of Trotskyism in some variety or another into the 21st century. So I suppose how do we think about Trotskyism? What is it? And Trotskyism, I suppose you could define it as a less a kind of political program and more a critique. To a large part, kind of Marxism was it offered certain sort of the possibilities of political programs, but it was largely a critique of capitalism. Trotskyism, much of Trotsky's writings, and it's difficult to kind of sum up the vast amount that Trotsky wrote, but an awful lot of it are explanations of the fate of the Russian Revolution, explanations for Stalinism, and critiques of what Stalin's Russia had become. And Trotsky essentially says that it's not a revolutionary state, it's a reactionary one. This is a state capitalist society. The revolution itself was throttled in its infancy largely by bureaucrats who, instead of wanting the ideas that Trotsky proposed, which was continual revolution or permanent revolution, opted for the building of socialism in one country, the collectivization of agriculture and the five-year plans, and the building of a large defense industry to face off against the inevitable threat from fascism. So that does kind of Trotsky's body of thought no justice at all, by the way. This is as brief a summation as we can get in a 25-minute podcast. But what I want to do now is look in the final chapter of Stalin's Nemesis. So Bertrand Paternod writes, Trotsky's ashes are buried in the patio of his home in Khoyakhan, beneath a monolith engraved with a large hammer and sickle. The Mexican government bought the house from Natalia in November 1940 and arranged for her to reside there as its caretaker. Over the next 20 years, she maintained the house just as it was when Trotsky lived there, leaving untouched even the remaining bullet holes from the May 1940 assault. This is, of course, the attack by the assassin Ramón Mercader and his accomplices that resulted in the murder of Leon Trotsky. He was obviously a Soviet agent, and the assassination was commissioned by Stalin himself. Natalia also kept a close eye on Trotsky's political legacy. In the United States, the Red Decade of the 1930s ended with a veritable stampede from Marxism. The exodus was abetted by the outpouring of patriotism during the Second World War. Despite the wartime alliance between the United States and Uncle Joe, Stalin's USSR, Trotsky's Fourth International persisted nonetheless, led from New York by James Cannon of the Socialist Workers' Party. Into the post-war years, the Fourth International continued to adhere to Trotsky's old position that Stalin's USSR was a degenerate workers' state, a designation it also applied to the Soviet bloc countries of Eastern Europe, which had been occupied by the Red Army at the end of the war. So let's unpack that a little bit. So there was, during the 1920s and 30s, a large and confident democratic and revolutionary left in America, of revolutionary parties and societies, a large communist party of the USA. There were radical and revolutionary newspapers sold in most of the major cities on the East Coast. There was an active trade union movement, and this the crises of the 1930s only swell the ranks of this kind of working class movement in America. Anything that is associated with Marxism after about 1944 suddenly becomes incredibly politically toxic, and there is a realization that America's wartime relationship of convenience with the USSR will come to an end at a certain point, and perhaps a higher price has been exacted by Stalin than the USA would ideally want to have paid. Sean McMeekin's book, Stalin's War, of which there's been some controversy. I'm still hoping to get onto the podcast, one of our listeners who we had some really interesting debates about it as a book. I think it has some merits, but it's a problematic read. But Sean McMeekin's argument is that the infiltration of the USSR of the USA by the USSR, even during the 1930s, was quite extensive, and Roosevelt bears a lot of blame for this. For Sean McMeekin's view, complacency. Not sure, but we'll come back to that another time. But the point being, there's this sudden and noticeable and a radical sea change in American public opinion away from socialist parties and ideas. Natalia was increasingly sceptical of this assessment of the the American Socialist Workers Party, which survived into the 1950s and 60s of the Soviet Union. She believed that were Trotsky alive, he would not consider the post-war USSR to be any kind of worker state. Privately, she told the leaders of the Fourth International that Stalinism had now completely destroyed the revolution, and that the so-called people's democracies of Eastern Europe were nothing more than Soviet vassal states, which, you know, I think is a fair assessment. The last straw for Natalia was the Korean War, which broke out in June 1950, and which Trotsky's disciples portrayed as a mortal struggle of the colonial peoples of the East against American imperialism. Natalia resigned from the Fourth International, a decision she explained at great length in an open letter to its executive committee. In it, she recalled that the greeting sent to her by the recent Congress of the Socialist Workers' Party, which had assured her that the party continued to be guided by Trotsky's ideas. "I must tell you that I read these lines with much bitterness," Natalia said. "As you will see from what I am writing to you, I do not see his ideas in your politics." So, let's unpack that. So the posthumous kind of carriers of the Trotskyite torch looked upon the events like the Korean War as a struggle between the colonized peoples and American imperialism. And Natalia believed that, Natalia Sedov, Trotsky's widow, believed that this was a nonsense, and that all that Trotsky would have looked at it would have been a war between two imperialisms, and that the Soviet-backed North Korea and eventually Maoist-backed North Korea waging war against America had no moral legitimacy, certainly was not interested in representing the oppressed peoples of Asia, nor capable of representing their interests, nor had any mandate to do so. So she looked upon this as a kind of like as a nonsense. Stalin's death in March 1953 was a major turning point in Soviet history. Lavrenty Beria was executed later that year, as the terror came to an end and the camps began to release their prisoners. Emerging as Stalin's successor, Nikita Khrushchev delivered a momentous speech in the 20th Party Congress of February 1956, denouncing Stalin's crimes and his cult of personality. Khrushchev limited his criticism to the wickedness of Stalin and his henchmen, carefully avoiding a wholesale indictment of the Soviet system. Khrushchev's de-Stalinization led to the political rehabilitation of selected victims of the terror, though not the defendants in the major purge trials, and certainly not Trotsky, whose name and image had been thoroughly erased in Stalin's time from books, museums and films. Trotsky remained useful as a Soviet bogeyman. However, when Mao Zedong accused Khrushchev of revisionism and challenged his leadership of the world communist movement, the Kremlin condemned the Chinese communists for their neo-Trotskyist deviation. After Khrushchev's speech, Natalia addressed a letter to the Soviet government, in the person of Clement Voroshilov, her husband's old antagonist, going back to the days of the Russian Civil War. As chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, Voroshilov was now formally head of state. Natalia wrote to him to ask for information about her son, Serozhia. The last news that she heard about him was his arrest in 1937 as a mass poisoner. Natalia never received a reply to her letter. There were many members of the kind of the wider Trotsky family, including Trotsky's son Lev, who died in very suspicious circumstances in Russia, or who were shipped off to the gulags and never heard of again. But to go back to this rehabilitation or not of certain figures, but definitely not of Trotsky. Trotsky's name by the 1930s, and certainly by the 1950s, had become a synonym for all that was bad with the revolution, all that had not occurred, all that had failed, all that had been unable to happen. And it becomes so divorced from any meaningful reality. It becomes sort of like the equivalent of kind of right-wing conservatives and sort of fascist types at the moment describing anything they don't like as woke. You know, eventually kind of Trotskyist, neo-Trotskyist deviationism means virtually nothing. It means you're not following the Stalinist, Marxist, Leninist party line. The fact that Mao viewed Khrushchev as doing essentially the same thing, I guess, sort of speaks volumes, really. It's interesting that of all the places for Trotskyism or post-Soviet Trotskyism to take root, the place where it grows its deepest roots really is the United States. There was a steady stream of earnest young intellectuals, journalists and revolutionaries from America who made pilgrimages to Trotsky's home in Khoyokhan and some staying there, others working for Trotsky. Back home in America, the development of the Socialist Workers' Party, of which a kind of a variant arrived in Great Britain in the late 1960s and is the kind of SWP of now.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Was under immense scrutiny from the US government, and Bertrand Patenaude writes, on the afternoon of the 27th of June 1941, a team of FBI agents and US Marshals raided the branch headquarters of the Socialist Workers' Party in Minneapolis and St. Paul. They seized a large amount of radical literature, two red flags, and an autographed photo of Trotsky. On the basis of this and other evidence, the federal authorities charged 29 Trotskyist militants with conspiracy against the US government. Four of the accused were national leaders of the Socialist Workers' Party: James Cannon, Farrell Dobbs, Al Goldman, and Felix Morrow. 14 others were connected to the Teamsters, including Ray Rainbolt, the chief of the Union's Defence Guard, and Dorothy Schultz, Hank's wife and Twin Cities secretary of the Workers' Defence League, as well as former Koyokan guards Jake Cooper and Emil Hansen, the better half of the disgruntled duo Bill and Emil. The indictment contained two counts, the first of which was charged the defendants with conspiracy to overthrow the government of the United States through armed revolution. The prosecution sought to demonstrate that the accused took their inspiration from the Russian Revolution and the ideas from Lenin and Trotsky. And accordingly, certain of the defendants would, and they did, go to Mexico. This is part of the indictment. To Mexico City, Mexico, there to advise and to receive the advice, counsel, and guidance and directions of said Leon Trotsky. The second count invoked the Smith Act of 1940, which made it a criminal offence to advocate the overthrow of the US government. Among the evidence presented in court was Trotsky's photograph and his writings, along with the published works of Marx and Engels and Lenin. So it's all fairly flimsy stuff. All the defendants were cleared of the conspiracy charge, but 18 of them were found guilty of violating the Smith Act, including Cannon, Dobbs, Goldman, Cooper and Hansen. Their prison sentence ranged from a year and a day to 16 months, and they began serving on the 1st of January 1944. The Communist Party aided the Justice Department in prosecuting, here's the interesting bit, prosecuting these Trotskyists by providing incriminating documents, some of which had been collected by Sylvia Caldwell, Cannon's secretary, who was an informant for the NKVD. After she was exposed by a communist defector in 1954, she was brought before a grand jury, refused to testify, including invoking her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. She finally confessed to her NKVD past before a second grand jury in 1958. So you have the Communist Party of the USA, a Stalinist institution, a Stalinist party, part of Comintern, helping the US government to hunt down and prosecute Trotskyists. And sometimes when one thinks about the imperative of, you know, solidarity and the kind of the mind rather boggles with the outrageous cynicism of Stalinists working with the epitome of capitalist state power to persecute another. One of the most telling stories in the kind of like the afterlife of Trotskyism was that of James Burnham. James Burnham, who, along with Sidney Hook, in 1933 had organised the American Workers' Party, which had merged with the Communist League to form the US Workers' Party the following year. He led the Trotskyist wing within the party, which was subsequently thrown out, and formed the Socialist Workers in the end. It formed the Socialist Party of America, which eventually the Trotskyists were forced out of that too, and formed the Socialist Workers Party in 1937. the Trotsky was a correspondent with Burnham. They wrote to one another throughout the 1930s, and Burnham was a great admirer of Trotsky's, but later became a kind of one of his bitterest enemies. Bertrand Paternaud writes, James Burnham, once Trotsky's most formidable adversary and bête noire inside the Socialist Workers' Party, turned his thesis about a brave new world of bureaucratic collectivism into a hugely successful book, The Managerial Revolution, published in 1941. As far as influential books on political science of the 20th century goes, this is kind of up there with the best of them. The Managerial Revolution is a hugely groundbreaking book for a whole range of reasons, but we won't talk about that now. The book stirred enormous controversy, not least because of the author's apparent cold-bloodedness about the dawning age of authoritarianism pioneered by the Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, and, in Burnham's opinion, New Deal America. George Orwell accused Burnham of looking forward to a German victory in the war and to a totalitarian future, a charge Burnham denied. Orwell later drew on Burnham's dark vision to create his dystopian masterpiece, 1984. After the war, the fiercely anti-communist Burnham, who'd had something of a kind of a Damascene moment in the late 1930s, fell out with Cold War liberals over their objections to the red-baiting crusade of Senator Joseph McCarthy, and he moved towards the political right. In 1955, the year of McCarthy's downfall, Burnham helped William F. Buckley, Jr., launch the conservative weekly National Review, contributing as a columnist and a senior editor. So Buckley being really kind of one of the founding figures of modern American conservatism, and the National Review being the kind of the house magazine of the American right. So it shows you how far Burnham had shifted from left to right. But Burnham's kind of advocacy of McCarthyism was that he had seen communism up close. He had been part of the revolutionary left. He was now a convert, and he said basically, you cannot fight an illiberal enemy using liberal methods. You have to be as ruthless as they are. Burnham and his fellow editors were early and unwavering champions of Ronald Reagan, who they helped get elected to the White House in 1980. In 1982, in a speech he gave to the British House of Commons, President Reagan famously declared, "The March of Freedom and Democracy will leave Marxism and Leninism on the ash heap of history." Few were aware at the time that Reagan's words were an ironic echo of Trotsky's banishment of the Mensheviks into the dustbin of history back in 1917. In 1983, the year Reagan characterised the Soviet Union as an evil empire, he awarded Burnham the Presidential Medal of Freedom. There is a kind of a long history of kind of journeys from the left to the right, throughout the story of neoconservatism, all the way up to the Iraq War of 2003. There were former kind of alumni of the revolutionary left in there who had really shifted violently to the right. So Burnham's story is by no means unique, but telling in general about there's a kind of the fluidity of 20th century ideas and 20th century kind of political ideas. What I want to do in sort of some kind of closing comments is sort of draw all the strands of this podcast together. Here you have this figure, this titanic figure in 20th century history, Leon Trotsky, who for good reasons and bad shaped the history of thought in the 20th century, and whose ideas outlive him, as they often do, outlive his violent murder. and whose adherents carry the money in all sorts of ways that were perhaps unintended. I mean, you know, there are all manner of people that attest to being Marxists after Marx's death, who Marx's ancestors and friends and fellow travellers and Friedrich Engels said, well, you know, that's completely not what Marx intended. And Trotsky's ideas have been similarly, shall we say, used, appropriated, and endorsed, rejected, and put to kind and sort of weaponized in some ways. And it sort of it tells us how the kind of the central titanic figure of the intellectual has very little say, very little control, very little power, other than, you know, whilst alive being a man of letters saying, no, I don't think you're right, and, you know, don't quote me on that, and I reject what you're having to say. I mean, and as a result, you know, Trotsky spent a great part of his life in a series of kind of furious debates. While Stalin was accumulating his power, Trotsky was in exile, angrily arguing with other people on the left on kind of revolutionary points of order of economics and diplomacy and dialectical materialism and all these sorts of things. And one of the kind of the characteristic features of the revolutionary left is this kind of endless schismatism, perhaps, which is always a gift to the forces of capitalism, and one of the reasons why they seem to relentlessly win everything all the time. Anyway, on that bleak note, I'll finish. I've added another interesting article to the Explaining History website, all about the kind of the state of the far right around the world at the moment. So go and check it out. I'm sure it's an entertaining read. And I'm looking to add a little bit more content here and there. I'm doing a few shorts on our YouTube channel, some things for students, and things of general interest. So check that out, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Take care, everybody. All the best. Bye bye.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.